Hello everybody and welcome to my review of David Rowan's King Lear from St John's College Gardens. Yes, I know I said I wouldn't do any reviews until the middle of August, but I saw it last night and I've been thinking about it all day and I can't really get anything done. And I'm hoping that by saying something to it, not only will I perform my duty as a reviewer in a timely fashion, but also I'll be able to get on with my life knowing at least I've said something about it. So there I was back at St John's with its trusty tree and its very trusty director, David Rowan. It's a fast-paced, action-packed King Lear. Well, it would have to be to fit in with the customary CSF play length. I can't really say I enjoyed it because it would be completely the wrong word. And obviously, you know anything about the play at all, you'll know what I mean by that. It certainly doesn't mean that I didn't appreciate it. I did, along with everyone else in the audience, as far as I could tell. Speaking of the audience, it was very sparse given the inclement weather, but I think particularly sparse because, not because of the weather as it was, there was light rain, but it wasn't really uncomfortable in any way at all. But unfortunately, the forecast leading up to it had been for heavy rain all night, and I think that probably put a lot of people off. The forecast did change very late on in the afternoon, but probably too late to get to many people's attention. Anyway, back to the play and the crucial opening scene, which we all know so well and has been done in so many ways over the years. Clever touch here. The map was, a very large map, was rolled out onto the grass, and Lear stood on it as he prepared to divide his kingdom amongst his daughters. He started to do that, he came off it, and then he went back on it again and was poised perfectly on it, illustrating that he was about to give Cordelia the choice cut of his kingdom before, of course, it all goes completely and utterly wrong. Lear was played once again by David Shackleton, who you'll remember perhaps from the CSF 2012. The last time I saw him as Lear was in a bright sunny afternoon at a matinee where he was dragging the poor fool around on a rope. And there is a review of that on the old site if you want to go back and look at previous shows. So it was quite a contrast weather-wise, and somewhat more apt this time round, although the weather wasn't, as I said, severe in any way, but it was more Lear-like than the sunshine. And of course, it had the evening darkness, which eventually came in, rather than the afternoon sunshine of the time before. For all that Lear goes through, and David Shackleton goes through as him, at the time I felt closest to him and most moved by was one of the less dramatic scenes. It was when he comes to near the end and he can't really believe where he is or if it really is Cordelia that is speaking to him. This is a very delicate scene and I thought it was performed very well by both David and indeed Cordelia, Rachel Fenwick, who will come on to in a moment. The two of them really performed it beautifully, and David's touch in sort of Lear's amazement, his not quite knowing what was happening, his unbelievable to him that it could be Cordelia, which of course perfectly matches it. It's such an important scene, and it's often doesn't come off well, and it came off very well, so I thought that was excellent. I was speaking of Rachel there as Cordelia, and she performed Cordelia admirably, but I have to say I was even more impressed by her portrayal of Oswald. What an interesting doubling of a role, the double role that was, Cordelia and Oswald. Talk about a contrast. Perhaps because I can't remember seeing it that way around before, or more likely actually just because Rachel was so outstandingly good as Oswald, I was quite carried away with that. And I mean, it is of course praise for her acting ability, but I don't mean for a second that I liked Oswald. It's an absolutely loathsome creature. He was so vile that I felt like cheering at his death and had to restrain myself, which is a testament to Rachel's performance, and certainly nothing against her, but that's what happens when you play a bad character. You get the audience all riled up. There were wonderful interchanges with Rob Gall's Kent. Again, more of that later, but the two of them together were brilliant. I really loved when Rob was chasing her, her being Rachel, him being Oswald, so I might get mixed up with my pronouns here, sorry. But when Rob, let's change it. When Kent was chasing Oswald around the garden and suddenly wrote, "Have you wisdom?" when Oswald wouldn't run away, it was really beautifully done. And there were many, many different interchanges between those. I was mentioning Rob Gall there. I should maybe do that before I go on about the two of them. Well, I said at the beginning that Rob Gall was made to play Kent, and he is Kent, and Kent is him. Everything I expected it to be, it was. It's just a fantastic performance from Rob. I particularly liked his accent change when Kent goes into disguise as a more lowly person. The accent becomes more northerly. Ah, well, there we go. Not northerly enough to be absolutely perfect, but still pretty northerly. And as I say, the interchange between him and Oswald was fantastic. It actually builds up, of course, to Kent being put in the stocks, which I felt was quite something to do to my Rob. And then Oswald and Rachel completely took it off the scale by spitting in his face when he was in the stocks. Really, the things you have to see. There was a very interesting touch with Kent that I can't remember seeing in any of the Lears I've seen before, but that could be my memory. But anyway, it came across as new to me, and very interesting. It's nothing in the text against it, nothing in the text as far as I can remember saying that it does happen. But what happened here was that the clown, played by Tessa, again, come on to that in a second, the fool, I beg your pardon, not the clown, the fool looked at the headgear of Kent in disguise and moved it and realised it was Kent, and they shared an intimate glance between each other. So Kent knew that the fool knew, and of course the fool knew what was going on. And this was interesting, I thought, because it gave them something in all the horrors that were to come up, that they at least knew the other one was there and aware of who each person really was. I'm sorry, I said that very badly. The fool knew who Kent was, and Kent at least knew that somebody out there knew his real identity. Of course, at first he was rather worried that the fool might blow it and give away his identity. But when that moment passed, he knew then that at least somebody and all the entourage and all the madness that was going on knew who he really was. And the fool knew that one of Lear's biggest supporters was still around. So I thought that was a really interesting touch. It was just a little moment, but it meant a lot, I felt. I've already started wandering through the play, as you do when you're dictating a review. So to go back to the beginning, the tableau of the map with the daughters was very striking. I should mention that Goneril, much like Oswald, absolutely in the sense of being absolutely mesmerising in her badness. L.J. Reeves was a perfect Goneril, really impressively dismissive. Aloof and altogether, well, I think evil's the only word I can think of. There were lots of lovely touches in the opening scene. One of them being Goneril's eyes when Kent was bidding farewell to Cordelia. And in fact, in all the conversations that she wasn't involved in, Goneril's eye movements were excellent, but they were absolutely priceless when Kent was bidding goodbye to Cordelia, and gave quite an insight into her character. It's possible that Kay Dent's Regan was doing the same thing, but the angle I was sitting at, and I had somebody in front of me, I couldn't see her face at this point. But Goneril's eyes were absolutely priceless. Speaking of Kay Dent, by the way, I was quite stunned for her to be a baddie, having seen her wonderful Miranda and Helena, and usually being such a put-upon and perfect person. To see her as a baddie was quite a change, and I suppose quite a refreshing change for her to play as well. The two evil daughters were... well, exemplary in their badness, and their fighting over Edmund was remarkably convincingly done. Of course, Goneril has, with Cornwell, played by Michael Guest, has the dubious honour of the scene where they put out Gloucester's eyes. Always one of the most painful things to watch in Shakespeare. Most of the painful things seem to be in this one play. But it's just a horrific moment. Those of you who saw it the last time at the CSF will remember the extremely graphic and bloody extraction of the eyes. This time, Gloucester's back was to us. I'm quite relieved of that in a way. But the eye scene was gripping and horrific in another sense by the sheer effort that it took Michael Guest as Cornwall to get the eyes out. And then the display of the long trailing bits behind the eye, it really makes you shudder. I thought the effort that was put into it was quite good. I'm saying good, but because I'm struggling for adjectives to say that the scene was very, very effective. But of course, it's something that really most of us would rather never see. Absolutely no pun intended. Meanwhile, the wonderful Andrew Stephen was there as Albany, an interesting character who developed who develops through the play, from sort of being bossed around almost by Reagan at times, but then growing into his own at the end. Another lovely moment in the opening scene was when Cordelia had given her answer of nothing to Lear, and Lear had cut her out of his kingdom and split it between Goneril and Regan, which of course means the means Albany and Cornwall. And Lear gave the crown to Cornwall, and Andrew Stephen's eyes, and indeed then his body, followed it around, and it was it's quite lovely the way he was transfixed by the crown and following it as Cornwall held it. There was a lot of the play in that one moment and that one look. I should also mention that Andrew Stephen and possibly even more so Michael Guest were involved in multiple doubling, which went on through the play. I'm beginning to find the doubling quite confusing with the men, as the fashion these days seems to be that nearly every man has a beard. Started having all these beards in all these different parts. It's getting quite difficult to keep up with them all. Needless to say, they were carried off with their normal competence here. The doubling roles, I mean. And speaking of doubling and tripling, you all know that I love Tessa Hatz, so I was in my element with multiple Tessa parts here. My favourite of her at least three roles was the Fool. Such a favourite, I think, for everybody who's ever seen Lear, the Fool, the character whose sudden disappearance leaves such a gaping hole in the whole thing. We always presume that the original reason that he suddenly disappears from the play is that the part was doubled with Cordelia in the original, which would certainly make sense for the quarto version of Lear. Though, of course, it could have been changed in the folio version. So much was changed in the folio version that, you know, stage restrictions would not necessarily have changed it there. But we've no idea of how the folio was concocted, how much was the Shakespeare's friends trying to be completely faithful to what he wrote, or if indeed the version in the folio was preferred by Shakespeare to the quarto version. These questions are endlessly fascinating, but also endlessly infuriating, because we'll never get an answer. So we don't really exactly know why the Fool disappears. The last few productions I've seen of Lear, the Fool's actually been disposed of in ways that I find, well, I can't say they're unsustainable, but it's just that the text doesn't give any backing to them at all. But one could always argue the text doesn't say it's impossible. I'm talking about the famous recent Simon Russell Beale example where Lear kills the Fool in a bathtub, which I didn't like at all, I have to say. Though I do find the way the Fool disappears saddening, and it was particularly sad, of course, because it wasn't Tessa, because Tessa was doing it, so I lost some of Tessa there. But there was a lovely relationship between David Shackleton and Tessa as Lear and the Fool, as there has to be for that one to work, of course. I haven't mentioned lots of people yet, and it's not because there's anything wrong or of lesser significance in their performance. It's just there's so much in this play. Every character at every moment is doing or saying something important, and it's impossible to cover them all at once. So I should mention Charles Maguire's Gloucester, because I've mentioned that he lost his eyes, and it was pretty unbearable. As you would imagine, Charles was a fantastic Gloucester, a little bit similar to what I was saying about Rob Gall as Kent whenever I knew he was playing him, which incidentally took me a long time to get it confirmed, even though it was my first guess. But enough of that. Charles seemed as perfect a choice for Gloucester as Rob was for Kent. And again, it turned out exactly as good as I expected it would. As I was mentioning before, this play is full of unbearable scenes. The unbearable scene where he thinks he's on the Cliff of Dover and jumps over is one of the greatest in all of Shakespeare, as far as I'm concerned. And it was wonderfully performed by Charles and his son Edgar, who was played by Lawrence Watling. Lawrence first enters the play actually as Franz, not the country, as Franz, taking the wonderful Cordelia as his wife. Very sensible move, and he was very dignified in that role. But I think he was actually born to play poor Tom, There were a little bit of shades of memory of his recent Caliban, and a little bit of memories of other parts he's played, but it was a pure role of being Poor Tom. So Edgar in disguise as Poor Tom, leading Gloucester to Dover, was just unbearable. One of the many nice small touches in the play, little things that just passed in a moment but had a big effect, was when Poor Tom was listening to Lear and his heart was breaking, and of course his disguised personality slips for a moment and his empathy and compassion comes through, and he said something in his normal voice and then looked shocked, caught himself, and went on into one of Poor Tom's rants, exaggerated even beyond that norm, to try and hide the fact up. But it made Tessa's fool look at him with curiosity, and I wondered if we were supposed to link that to the fool realizing that Kent was Kent. For just for a minute, the fool looked like he'd been aware of the change of voice. He didn't actually look like he knew, but he certainly looked puzzled, and I just thought it was another little nice touch. Another good touch, presumably from director David Drowen, was in an effort to cram as much of the play into the time we've got. We had some simultaneous speech going on when the fool found Poor Tom in his hovel, and Poor Tom came out and started ranting. At the same time, Lear was giving an important speech on his knees. So you had one of Lear's most important speeches, but it's kind of a bizarre thing to say because they're all so important. But it was a very famous and very great speech, of course, that Lear was giving, whilst at the meantime the fool was sort of shrieking in surprised horror at finding this bizarre creature, Poor Tom, and Poor Tom was in full mode of deranged ranting to convince everybody that he was indeed a mad, bad beggar. Well, not bad, but a mad beggar. Now, I knew the way I was giving this dictation that at some point or another I would come to somebody that I hadn't mentioned so far and feel terrible, and that's exactly what's happened now. And I feel terrible because it's Scott Loder's Edmund, who was a very, very strong stage presence. But terrible, isn't it? It's just typical. We leave the bastard to the end. Ha. And speaking of the unfair treatment of bastards at the time, Edmund arrives on the stage and Scott Loder lets you know in no uncertain terms why he turns out to be such an evil so-and-so before his change of heart at the end. The opening speech, very loud, very dynamic, about the world and why bastards and all the anger and all the resentment of his position, was really driven home. He burst to the front of the stage, but you know what I mean, the stage area, the grass area. He burst to the front of the grass area, grabbed the audience by the throat and shook us as he was declaiming his position. I thought that was very powerful and very good. He stayed suitably Edmund-like throughout. He was very lucky because he had both Kay Dent and Rachel Fenwick fawning after him, which can't be bad for anybody's ego. And he actually was even quite convincing as he changes at the end. I always find that a little bit difficult because he's been so evil that his change at the end, I think, can be quite difficult. But the way he was so mortally wounded, and that was brought across that he really was in his dying breaths, that he was trying to save Cordelia, and of course he was too late, as we all know. And then we have the horrific last few minutes, which are just unbearable, played by anybody. And after an evening where I'd been so impressed, it just rips the guts right out of you, those four famous last moments. So there we go. Wonderful to everybody. I have not given this as much detail as it deserves because, as I say, I wasn't actually really expecting to be reviewing it for another couple of weeks. I'll be seeing it again next week, and I very much look forward to it. And I'm pretty sure I'll manage to see it a third time before it closes. I certainly hope so, because twice won't be nearly enough. In the bizarre, odd situation that somebody might be listening to my reviews and not actually going to all of the plays, make sure you don't miss this one.